Be advised, I see midway up the World Trade Center tower, heavy black smoke coming out. Also, it seems like heavy damage to the upper portion of the building cave.
Thin Line Believers is a Christ-based outreach for the men and women who walk the thin line between good and evil, order and chaos. Our motto is, our service for His glory. To the police officers, veterans, firefighters, corrections, paramedics, dispatchers, and whoever else may join us, we are so glad you're here.
All right, well, welcome back to Thin Line Believers Podcast. Once again, we're happy you're here. We're happy to bring some words to your life and some encouragement to what you may be facing being in the career path that we're in. Again, today I'm joined by Ollie Perez, who you guys all listened to last week speak about his faith walk. And today we're going to get a little further into his story and towards the real meat portion of his walk with Christ. So thanks for being here again, Ollie.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's my pleasure.
Yeah. So we were talking about, talking about your child abuse detective role that you had, and maybe some of the trials and just some of the dirt that comes up and that sticks to you, like you put in the last portion of the podcast. And just wondering if you could touch on that a little bit and shed some light for some of these folks.
You know, it's the horrific physical and sexual abuse of the small kids, you know, from infant and toddler all the way up to 13. And we saw this abuse in varying degrees. And you guys, whatever capacity you're in, whether you're a detective, whether you're on patrol, whether you're in a specialized unit, you're going to come across it in your search warrants or however you stumble across this on a call. And the things that stick with you are the ones that just, you know, it was always the ones that when the baby's in the hospital and the brain is swelling, and, you know, a couple of them where the kid was thrown down the hallway and bounced off the walls and every bone in the body's almost broken and the brain swells and things like that. And wow. Those are the kinds of things that stick with. And that's the physical abuse side. And then the sexual abuse side is a whole nother animal, where
whole nother level, right?
It's a whole nother level of nasty, and that one sticks to you, where this one affected me when I would get these sexual abuse cases against these small toddlers and babies and young kids that can hardly speak, and it would mess with my mind that I would go home, and you know, it would affect me when I'm, you know, with my wife and we're just talking, and these things would be, so these thoughts would be flooding my mind, you know, and it just it's tough. It was tough to process, and I'm not gonna go over here and say, oh, I'm super deputy bitch and this and that, and I didn't have a single problem. No, there's some of this stuff affected me, you know, and there was times when we would take pause and be like, man, this is I see something, and I'm like, man, this is like, what's going on in my casework? I don't know. It messed with my head.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you know, it messed with my intimacy with my wife a little bit. There was a couple of times, you know, I'm like, hey, man, I'm trying to be with my wife, but man, I'm having thoughts of this case and what was happening in the case, and now I'm all out of whack and I'm all freaked out. So that happened. And that's real. That's dirt under the nails. That's as plain as I can say. And it took a minute. It took some adjusting to get used to. I always try to not bring work home, but it's impossible. It is impossible, and especially at this level. So what I found worked best was I started, funny concept, talk to your wife. I started talking to her I started, you know, communicating with her about, hey, this case has got my head in a knot.
Mm-hmm.
And I try to unravel it with her, you know, and she was awesome. And that really helped on the rough one. That didn't happen every case, but there's a handful of cases that I left there with that grabbed a hold of me pretty strong.
Right.
And of all things, you know, I always thought, well, if I have a law enforcement problem, I'll talk to my partners because we're on the ground together. And guys, go figure, talk to your wife, like deep down underneath the nails, talk to your wife.
Absolutely.
You'd be surprised what an all-star she turns out to be.
Mm-hmm.
And that was huge. And it really helped me navigate through some very challenging cases. And I'm really grateful for my wife, Gracie, for doing that for me. And so those
sounds
are some
like
of the.
You got a good one.
I way outkicked my coverage, dude. And so, you know, those are some of the challenges that I faced there in child abuse. And I remember the first 6 months I was there, man, I felt like I was a trainee in phase training all over again. I had armpit sweat by 7 in the morning, you know, because I really wanted to do a good job. And I got there, and I was working with very fine investigators. And they had just, you know, what I noticed, what just separated them is their interviewing skills were outstanding. I mean, I don't get impressed very often, you know. I've hopped and popped and this and that. I'm not going to talk about my career, pat myself on the back. But I've seen enough, as have you guys, that it doesn't, you know, it takes a lot to be impressed. Because it is what it is. But I watched these detectives work, and I was like, they're on a whole nother level, and I need to kick up my game. And so I remember, I remember just putting in the extra effort as much as I could.
Mm-hmm.
Because I wanted to, I didn't want to be a burden to my partners. I didn't want them to feel like, oh, God, I got to babysit Ollie again. Really?
Right.
And so I remember telling him, okay, I went and told the bosses, and again, I'm not bragging. This is how I survived. I would not have survived without this, okay? I told the supervisors, I said, I'm on call until you guys tell me I'm not. And so I told the detectives in front of me and behind me, I said, I'll take your call outs. But and not to pat myself on the back, I need the learning experience. I need the knowledge base.
Right.
And so if you guys will just come with me on the call out, you soak up the overtime. Help me out, walk me through it, keep me in bounds. I'll do all the heavy lifting. And it worked out great, and I had awesome partners. They've been over backwards to really bring me up to speed quickly. And so then when the call out phone rang at 2 a.m., I didn't break out into the sweats anymore. I was prepared and ready, and it was pretty nice. It took me a good solid 6 months to get a foundation, and then it took me about another 6 months to get up and running where it was high, where now I could have fun. You know, I felt like the learning process was, I felt like I had a good knowledge base that I could do, that I'd consider myself just a journeyman detective. You know, I was nowhere near the senior guy. And finally some new people came in, and that felt great because I wasn't the new guy anymore.
Right.
And so then that pushes us out to year two, or the second year of my career, and where we were really moving along. We had a well-oiled machine. We were doing a lot of high-profile cases and major cases, and we were doing good work, and a lot of people were getting taken into custody and going through the process that way. And so it was a really good time. And so on September 25th, 2012, I show up to work, you know, fat, dumb, and happy, and my boss hands me this yellow sticky and goes, hey, Ollie, I need you to go to the Santee station and take care of this case. There's a mom there that's got some child porn on the phone. And trying to be the slick detective that I am, I'm like, child porn on the phone? That's downloaded off the internet. That's federal. I don't do federal. Send that over to the feds, boss. 10.2 second case handled. Right? And then, you know, you get the one eyebrow up. Really? I need you for that? No. Go down there and take care of this case because it's her two daughters, 6 and 8. that's on the phone. And then it's like, then everything comes to a screeching halt. And this is only on face value. And like everything, everything's got to be verified and corroborated, and a whole bunch of work needs to be done. But just based on that alone, if what my boss is telling me is actually factually accurate, that means there's somebody captured some abuse on video with two victims. So now it's multiple victims over a prolonged period of time. You know, the whole nuclear bomb, this could potentially be a laptop case.
Right.
But I'm just in the ultimate preliminary stages of it. So I grabbed the sticky and I said, okay, boss, I'm on it. And then one thing I always, this is the guy that hired me, you know? And so when he gives me something, I don't come back until it's done.
Yeah.
You know, I want to be able to prove that, hey, I was a good pick. I wasn't a wasted pick.
Right.
You know, and I carried that with me the whole time I was in child abuse. I know that because I knew I was given this huge opportunity and I didn't want to blow it. So I just wanted to go above and beyond any time. I wanted to work hard for my boss, man, because he gave me a crack at it. And I like to say, and then I talked to him about it personally, that I delivered. So I'm happy with that. And so I go there and I gather all the senior detectives and I said, okay, this is what I got and this is what I want to do about it. Am I leaving anything out that you guys think is important? And they said, no, we like your plan. Let us know if you need any help. We'll be happy to help out. Well, you know, I had a partner that I always worked with. His name is Dustin. And I said, okay. He had a case up in Vista, which is about an hour from our office. He had a case about an hour in North San Diego County, and I was going half an hour east of San Diego County. So we were going to be far apart.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, when you're done with your business in Vista, meet me out at the address, because if this goes the way I think it's going to go, I'm going to need your help with a telephonic search warrant on the place. And he said, okay, no problem. And so we set up, and so I head out to Santee. And now I spent 10 years of my career out of this station working in Santee Lakeside and unincorporated El Cajon. And and in various capacities as patrol, as an FTO, as community policing, as gang suppression, and then patrol. So I still knew, let's see, this was in 2012. I left in 2009. So I still knew about half the station there after turnover. And so I was very familiar with the station, very familiar with most of the people that worked there, and had a lot of friends and former partners there. And so I get there and there was a young deputy there, and we pick it up from there, and I meet with the mom. And I get mom comfortable. We get our own little quiet space. And first words out of her mouth are, I don't trust law enforcement. My ex-husband's doing a very lengthy prison sentence because the detectives lied, falsified, and manipulated the evidence.
Wow.
And I said, okay, you and I were just meeting for the first time. And I said, I'll tell you what, you don't have to like me. You don't have to trust me. I said, but why don't you let me work for your kids? Why don't you tell me what's going on and let me go to work for your kids and let my work speak for itself.
Yeah.
And so it took me about 45 minutes of talking with her, because her greatest fear, believe it or not, was not that she just found out her kids were being sexually molested and abused, but that we were going to take her kids from her. And so I said, okay, why don't you just walk me through what happened? And she said, okay, here's the deal. I thought my man was cheating on me. So I woke up early and I got into his cell phone and I started going through it and I started looking for texts or pictures or whatever from the other woman. And what I ended up finding was 18 photos and 7 videos of him horribly molesting my 6 and 8 year old.
Oh, man.
And so what I did is I took the memory card out of his phone. I grabbed the girls. And I went down to his work, and I told everybody at his work that he was a child molester, and they got all riled up. And then I took the kids to grandma's house, and now I'm here with you. And I said, okay, let's break this down. So what's the first thing you did when you found out that your kids were being hurt? Well, I got them out of there. And I'm like, that's awesome. That's called being a protective mother.
Mm-hmm.
As long as you remain a protective mother, you will keep your kids. Don't deviate from this path at all, because if you do anything that put the kids back in danger, if you bring your kids back next to this guy, if it's, oh, I feel bad, I'm sorry, but I still love him, he's not a bad guy, or any other myriad of excuses, and you put your kids in harm's way, I promise they're going to take your kids. So don't do that. I'm telling you how to keep your kids and how you will lose your kids. So this is exactly how you do it. And then she shows me, you know, she gets the phone out, she puts the memory card, and she shows me the videos and the photos. And that was a moment I'm like, this is you know, you can work 1,000 cases and never get evidence this compelling. And it was so overwhelming and compelling against the defendant that the judge would not allow the videos to be played at trial or prelim.
Wow.
And so I'm going to do a little side note here. I had an awesome prosecutor. His name was Damon Mosler. And he said, okay, we won't play the video, but what I'm going to do is I'm going to take the video and I'm going to break it into still photos, and I'm going to bring in thousands of, you know, 1,000 yeah. photos mm-hmm. of play-by-play of what this guy was doing and show it to the jury one by one. And, you know, but if they can make it through three of them, you know, without gagging, it'd be a miracle. So she shows me this, and I know instantly that we've got a major case, and this is going, you know, you could work your whole career and not get it this good. And so she finally agrees to get on board. You know, she said, hey, her complaint about her ex-husband, and I didn't address that, so I'll address it now. She lived in Virginia. She was married, and she had 4 children. Her husband molested her older 2 kids for a long period of time. And when the investigators confronted him with the evidence that, you know, he admitted to it. And so he got a 47-year prison sentence for molesting her older 2 kids.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the real, that's the facts and truth about that. Nobody, you know, I know I'm talking to a law enforcement audience, but it just nobody tampered with any kind of evidence at any point in the investigation. And so she finally agrees to get on board with the investigation. She's like, you know, I did this with the detectives in Virginia, and I'm kind of familiar with what's going to happen. Well, I don't even have my recording equipment set up because I'm still just trying to talk to her, get a baseline of what happened, get the case going. And so bad guy wakes up, realizes that the memory card's removed from his phone, so he starts blowing up her phone. So what I did, ultimately, I grabbed 3 calls from him. Each of them are about half hour long. And they're all denials. Wasn't me, didn't do it. Nope, that's not my face. Nope, that's not my picture. Nope, I didn't do it. Deny for the first 2 calls. And then the last call, the last 10 minutes, he doesn't confess, but he gives an admission. And he says, you know, okay, I don't want to talk about this over the phone, but here's the deal. I was offered $50,000 by some guy to make these videos. And I did it for us because we're struggling. We're struggling financially, and I want us to have a better life. And so I did it for us so we could get ahead. I'd never hurt the girls because molesting them repeatedly doesn't hurt them. And I was always gentle, so that makes it okay. It makes my blood boil every time I talk about it. And then he's like, so I never heard it, and I just did it for us because I love you and I love the girls, and this is how we express our love to our family, by violating little kids. And so he gives her this big cock and bull story, and then he says, but I don't want to talk about it anymore. Why don't you come home now? Why don't you bring the girls home, and I'll tell you everything. And that's a wrap right there. Boom.
Wow.
We kill the call. She says, I'm too angry. I'm stressed out right now. I'm at my mom's house. I'll be home, and I'll be home when I'm ready. Hangs up. I said, don't answer the phone. Don't take any more calls. And this is going to be a wrap. But he kept blowing it up. And she answered, I think she answered 1, maybe 2 more times. And he was just imploring her to go back home. Come home now.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, you know what? I'm upset. I need time. I'm at my mom's. I'll be there when I get there. You just need to relax. And so then that's it. And so So we kill the call. Now, as far as evidence-wise, I've got audio admission, I've got still photos, and I've got video in action. I've got all the evidence I need. And this is just go down there, grab this guy, book him, and then get enough info in to get through the arraignment, and then spend the next month working on the case for the prelim. And then so she tells me, she goes, "Hey, I want you to know something that he's got some guns." And at this point, I've been on the department 18 years, and I expect it, and I'm like, okay, well, when it's Lakeside, everybody's got guns, and I'm not overly concerned about it, because I wasn't working bikers, and I wasn't working gangsters, and I wasn't working parolees.
Right.
I was working these pedophiles, and when you work with pedophiles, the size, color, and shape and texture may change, but some behavior characteristics I learned along the way kind of remain the same. They're not type A aggressive at all. They're non-confrontational. They don't have good social skills. They don't interact very well. And they, they prey on kids, but you run their background, and they have minimal to no law enforcement contact. So we ran this guy up, we did a background on him, and he had a misdemeanor out of Wisconsin, a misdemeanor vandalism, and he had a misdemeanor DV against his girlfriend. Well, she didn't cooperate with the DA's office, so they dismissed the case. And so he had two misdemeanors, so nothing to get excited about, nothing to call our SED our weapons guys.
Right.
So we have this whole checklist we go through. We ran this guy up, and there was nothing that set off bells and whistles. And so, and not only that she warned me about that, but she left some things out that I thought were pretty important. What she left out was, one, he's a complete and total psychopath. That would have been nice. Two, that he's an avid outdoorsman, hunter, and shooter, and that he practices and trains with his weaponry often.
Oh, man.
And he knows his way around weapons. If she left all that out. She goes, "He's got some guns. I'm not really sure." And so, just based on my 2 years experience and all the people we've been taking in, we did search warrants on previous cases, guys, closet full of guns. They're not violent, aggressive.
Right.
They're not cut from that cloth.
Yeah.
And so I wasn't overly concerned about it. And so I'm like, okay. And then she even sweetened the deal and said, okay, here's the keys to my apartment. Here's a signed consent form that says you have permission to go into my apartment, take whatever you think is important to the investigation, and you have my permission. And, oh, by the way, we live in the front of the complex, so don't go through the front gate. Go around back or he'll see you coming.
Huh.
He gives me best avenue of approach.
Right.
Keys and consent, the whole bit. And so I'm like, okay, this is good. So I pause, I make her comfortable, I go back into the community policing unit, and they were all my old partners and former trainees, and I was like, okay, look, I'm gonna go grab this child molester. I need a little bit of help. And everybody stopped what they were doing to help. I got so much help, it was awesome. I never in any of my cases got this kind of help. And so I had enough. When we sent surveillance out on the place, supervisor jumped on board, and I think I still had room for five or six others.
Right.
And one of them had a trainee, I think. So he's like, "Hey, I want to bring him along." I'm like, "Yeah, bring him." And so we put our game plan together, the whole ops plan, do that, send that over to the comp center, run it through, make sure there's no conflicts. We do that whole walkthrough. So we've got a plan. I call my partner Dustin and I said, "Hey, change your plans. Instead of meeting me at the station, meet me out at the address. This is the address." And he said, "Okay." I said, "This is a go. We're going to go grab him. We're going to go take him into custody." So they go out there, and surveillance gets out there first, and they're like, "Yeah, we got him. He's going back and forth from the front porch, from the front upstairs porch to the patio back inside." And I'm like, "Okay." And so the last thing I do before I head out to Lakeside, which is about 4 miles, 3.5, 4 miles from the station, it's about a mile from my house. And I told her, I said, "Until you see me face to face, don't go anywhere near that apartment. When I'm done taking care of business, I'll come back, I'll meet you, I'll find you, and I'll tell you when it's safe to go back in." And she said, "Okay, fine." So we leave. We go and set up to do our business. And what ends up happening is between the time I left and the time I got there, she called him.
Oh, man.
And we can prove that she called him because they were on the phone together later on when I end up kicking open the front door.
Wow.
But what we could never prove was the contents of the conversation. I'm kind of jumping forward here a little bit.
No, that's good. And I think, I'm on the edge of my seat. I already know what happens. And so I know that the guys and gals that are listening are waiting to hear what's going to happen. And if they haven't heard your story, I mean, it's something that is to be told. I mean, it's amazing.
And the DA tried for over a year to get this guy to admit over the phone. We listened to every phone call he made to admit that she warned him, and then she would have got jammed up and been charged as an accessory and got the same time he got.
Right.
But so my team gets over there, surveillance has him out there. We know he's there. I'm talking to my partner Mike. Mike and I have been friends for years and years and years, even before he was in law enforcement. He transferred over from San Diego Police Department, and we've been good friends for forever. And so he's talking about, yeah, man, I'm opening up a CrossFit gym, this, that, and the other. And I'm like, dude, you're going to leave the sheriff's department for a CrossFit gym? I said, why don't you just run it? He's like, no, I'm going to do both. I'm like, all right. So we're talking, it's like, okay, we put all the pieces in place. We got the apartment surrounded. It's going to be low and slow, low key. I'm going to go knock on the door, use my award-winning personality, bring this guy outside. We're going to cuff him, stuff him, search him. And then we're going to get the warrant on the house. This is, I'm going to be out of here by 5-6 o'clock tonight, and it's going to be a wrap. And that's what's going on in my mind. I've done this a million times now. So in my mind, I said, I've got all the pieces in place to have a successful outcome. Now it's just go forth and do it. And so gear up, throw on my vest, grab my gear, head up to the door. And I'm with, it's me, the supervisor, Craig, Mike, Brett, Danielle, and somebody else. I don't remember who. I don't remember. It was like six of us. But I'm up first, so I'm going to be first through the door, last one to leave. So I go and I go pound on the door. I call him out by first and last name. And this is a small little, 500, 600 square foot apartment. It's not that big at all.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm using my big boy voice, and I'm letting the entire apartment complex know, one, the sheriff's department is here, and two, we want to talk to this guy. And he's not coming to the door. And I gave that an honest minute. Now, I have keys and consent. I can just walk right in, but,
right.
experience teaches me, don't walk into somebody's house unannounced, because that's the surest way to get into a conflict that you could have avoided. I'm not worried about him flushing or destroying evidence. I've got all the evidence I need.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not worried about destruction of evidence. I don't have a pressing issue here. This is low and slow, knock and talk, easy. And so I'm beating on the door. He's not coming. And so I'm like, all right, we know he's there. He does not want to be held accountable for his actions. So I start on the bottom lock. And I get to the bottom lock, I put the key in, and I turn it. I'm getting ready to go to the deadbolt because I tried the door and the deadbolt was wrong. I'm getting ready to go to the deadbolt, and somebody in the back of the apartment radios in and goes, hey, I hear a little girl screaming, and I cannot tell if it's the apartment you guys are trying to get into or one next to it. And that just right there, my whole investigation went from low and slow to a whole nother level. I've got firsthand experience in audio and video of what he does to small girls when he's alone and when he has the opportunity. And so it is just, there's no way, if there's a 1/1,000,000th of a possibility that there's a small child in there, that now exigent circumstances come into play. So immediately I go to the deadbolt. I try the deadbolt. It's rigged from the inside. We know he's there. He doesn't want to be held accountable for his actions. It's a trick we've seen in the jail 1,000 times. They rigged the lock shut. And so my supervisor asked me, and he says, hey, Ollie, you going to boot the door? And I'm like, absolutely. And so, and I always try to make sure I honor him for this, because he's like, hey, you'll kick it. And I'm so glad that he said that, you know, because it plays a huge deal later on here in the next coming minutes. And so ultimately what ends up happening is I put my back to the door. Now, there's some environmental stuff going on too. It is a bright, bright, sunny day out in Lakeside. And it's like high noon, okay? So it's a big, is a bright, sunny day. And remember that she called and tipped him off that we were coming. Well, he used that time to black out the apartment. He put towels and sheets and blankets over all the window coverings. And he turned out all the lights. So I kicked the door, and I'm going to use a little humor here because it's kind of funny. I don't know if when you kick the door, if this ever happened to you. The whole bottom half of the door bent in and then snapped back. And I'm not a small guy. You know, I, at the time, I was about 270 pounds, and I was 6'2". And my buddy Mike's looking at me, you know, Mr. CrossFit. He's looking at me. He don't say it, but he's like, really? You can't get the door open. So, you know, my manhood gets called into question. And so now I do the Hulk smash, right? So I boot the door the second time. It goes flying, and I take the door trim and some of the frame, and everything goes flying in, and I take one step into this pitch-black apartment, and all hell breaks loose. What happened is he was proned out about 10 feet away. He had an M1 Garand chambered in a 308, and he opened fire. And the first round hit me in the left arm, dead center of my humerus. And it blew 5 inches of my humerus, disintegrated him into bone fragments, and threw all those bone fragments into my chest cavity. It ripped off my bicep, severed my brachial artery, and it just almost completely severed my left arm. The only thing holding my arm together was my tricep. And I remember exactly what it felt like. It just, a white flash of light. From the pain, not from the, and that was, I barely heard the gunshot. Talk about auditory exclusion. Yeah. It sounded like a dud firecracker, and it was a 308 inside, you know, supersonic, inside enclosed space. And it almost, and so what happened is it forced me, the impact hit me, and I did a 90 degree turn. So now I'm face to face with a bad guy. And then, you know, it knocked me down. And so if you guys ever seen one of those UFC fights where the guy gets knocked out and his whole body locks up and seizes up, that's what happened to me. My whole body locked up and seized up. So I was incapacitated and defenseless. Now, this is where I like to honor my partners, okay, because Mike and Craig, the supervisor, they were the only ones up on the landing with me. They could have all dove down the stairs, hid under a rock, and regrouped. But what they did is they immediately returned fire. And they saved, you know, they saved me several times during this whole event because they returned fire, and it took the attention off of me, and it put it on them. And so by doing that, suspect changes firing positions. He starts running all over the apartment and firing from different positions throughout the inside of the apartment. And he's firing, you know, everything's going through the walls, this, that, and the other. And I'm over here laid out. I'm the only one. I'm right in the, like, right inside the threshold of the apartment. I'm the only one that made it inside. Mm-hmm. And so I recover. And so what happens is everything slows down. So what's going to take me about 10 minutes to describe, it happened in a matter of seconds. So I remember my eyes coming up, and I'm on my back, and I'm like, what just hit me? What truck just hit me? And then I can hear the gunfire, and I'm like, okay. And I can see him. I can see a blur of him running, you know, side to side, running back and forth. And I'm like, okay, I've been shot. And I'm like, oh, how bad is it? I don't know. Let me check. So I started up my toes. And I started working my way up my body looking for holes. And I'm like, okay, you're good, you're good, you're good, you're good, you're good. And then I got to my chest, and I'm like, I feel my arm resting across my chest, but I don't see my arm. And it was like I feel it, like it's there. Like my brain is telling me my arm is right here, rest draped across my chest at a you know, at a right angle. But my arm's not there, so I was perplexed by that. Meanwhile, all this gunfire is going on, and I'm like, well, where's my arm? I can feel it, but I don't see it. And I look, and then that's when I notice it's up over my head, but it's spun the wrong way.
Oh, man.
And I'm like, oh, that's bad. I'll get back to that in a minute. So then I said, okay, is there any other holes besides that? And a couple of things popped into my head. I'm like, okay, your brachial artery's been severed, and you got about 4 minutes before you pass out. Then you got about 4 minutes after that, and it's game over. So for the next 4 minutes, you're going to kill this man. And,
I think this is the perfect time, knowing this story and having heard you speak on it a couple times. I'm going to leave the guys in a little bit of suspense right now.
All right.
I know that's a little mean of me, but it's well worth it. So what I'd like to do, we'll take a pause, we'll take a break, and we'll come back with Ollie for the last portion of this story, which is truly amazing and miraculous. You know, it's probably the easiest and best way that I can explain what is about to happen and what has happened with Ollie since then. So let's take a break, and we'll come back with Ollie at the next podcast, and we'll continue on with his story and hit the final stages of it.